Ralph made the appointment to see Dr. Litchfield less than an hour after his conversation with Lois on the park bench. The receptionist with a cool, sexy voice told him she could fit him in next Tuesday morning at 10 if that was okay. And Ralph told her that was fine as paint. Then he hung up, went into the living room, sat in the wing chair that overlooked Harris Avenue, and thought about how Dr. Litchfield had initially treated his wife's brain tumor with Tylenol 3 and pamphlets explaining various relaxation techniques. From there, he moved on to the look he'd seen in Litchfield's eyes after the magnetic resonance imaging tests had confirmed the CAT scan's bad news. That look of guilt and unease. Across the street, a bunch of kids who would soon be back in school came out of the Red Apple armed with candy bars and Slurpees. As Ralph watched them mount their bikes and tear away into the bright 11 o'clock heat, he thought what he'd always did when the memory of Dr. Litchfield's eyes surfaced, that it was most likely a false memory. The thing is, old buddy, you wanted Litchfield to look uneasy, but even more than that, you wanted him to look guilty. Quite possibly true. Quite possibly Carl Litchfield was a peach of a guy and a hell of a doctor. But Ralph still found himself calling Litchfield's office again half an hour later. He told the receptionist with a sexy voice that he'd just rechecked his calendar and discovered next Tuesday at 10 wasn't so fine after all. He'd made an appointment with the podiatrist for that day and forgotten all about it. "My memory's not what it used to be," Ralph told her. The receptionist suggested next Thursday at 2. Ralph countered by promising to call back. "Liar, liar, pants on fire," he thought as he hung up the phone, walked slowly back to the wing chair and lowered himself into it. "You're done with him, aren't you?" He supposed he was. Not that Dr. Litchfield was apt to lose any sleep over it. If he thought about Ralph at all, it would be as one less old geezer to fart in his face during the prostate exam. "All right, so what are you going to do about the insomnia, Ralph?" "Sit quiet for half an hour before bedtime and listen to classical music," he said out loud. "Buy some Depends for those troublesome calls of nature." He startled himself by laughing at the image of himself sitting solemnly in his chair, wearing nothing but a pair of adult disposable diapers and listening to Bach. The laughter had a hysterical edge he didn't much care for. It was damn creepy, as a matter of fact, but it was still a little while before he could make himself stop. Yet he supposed he would try Hamilton Davenport's suggestion, although he would skip the diapers, thank you, as he had tried most of the folk remedies well-meaning people had passed on to him. This made him think of his first bona fide folk remedy, and that raised another grin. It had been McGovern's idea. He'd been sitting on the porch one evening when Ralph came back from the Red Apple with some noodles and spaghetti sauce, had taken one look at his upstairs neighbor and made a tisk-tisk sound, shaking his head dolefully. "What's that supposed to mean?" Ralph asked, taking the seat next to him. A little further down the street, a little girl in jeans and an oversized white T-shirt had been skipping rope and chanting in the growing gloom. "It means you're looking folded, spindled, and mutilated," McGovern said. He used one thumb to tilt the Panama back on his head and looked more closely at Ralph. "Still not sleeping?" "Still not sleeping," Ralph agreed. McGovern was quiet for a few seconds. When he spoke again, he did so in a tone of absolute, almost apocalyptic, in fact, finality. "Whiskey is the answer," he said. "I beg your pardon?" "To your insomnia, Ralph. I don't mean you should take a bath in it. There's no need of that. Just mix a tablespoon of honey with half a shot of whiskey and hook it down 15 or 20 minutes before you hit the hay." "You think?" Ralph had asked hopefully. "All I can say is it worked for me, and I had some real problems sleeping around the time I turned 40. Looking back on it, I guess that was my midlife crisis. 6 months of insomnia and a year-long depression over my bald spot." Although the books he'd been consulting all said that booze was a vastly overrated cure for sleeplessness, that it often made the problem worse instead of better, in fact, he had tried it just the same. He'd never been much of a drinker, so he began by adjusting McGovern's recommended half-shot dosage down to a quarter of a shot. But after a week of no relief, he had upped the ante to a full shot, then to two. He woke up one morning at 4:22 with a nasty little headache to accompany the dull brown taste of early times on the roof of his mouth, and realized he was suffering his first hangover in 15 years. "Life's too short for this shit," he had announced to his empty apartment, and that had been the end of the great whiskey experiment. "Okay," Ralph thought now as he watched the desultory mid-morning flow of customers in and out of the Red Apple across the street. "Here's the situation. McGovern says you look like shit. You almost fainted at Lois Chass's feet this morning, and you just canceled the appointment you made with ye old family physician. So what next? Just let it go? Accept the situation and let it go?" The idea had a certain oriental charm. Fate, karma, and all that. But he was going to need more than charm to get him through the long hours of early morning. The book said there were people in the world, quite a lot of them, who managed very well on no more than 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. There were even some who got along on only 2. They were an extremely small minority, but they did exist. Ralph Roberts, however, was not among their number. How he looked wasn't very important to him. He had a feeling that his matinee idol days were well behind him. But how he felt was, and it was no longer just a matter of not feeling good. He felt horrible. The insomnia had begun to pervade every aspect of his life, the way the smell of frying garlic on the 5th floor will eventually pervade an entire apartment building. The color had started to drain out of things. The world had begun to take on the dull, grainy quality of a newspaper photograph. Simple decisions, whether to heat up a frozen dinner for his evening meal or grab a sandwich at the Red Apple and go up to the picnic area by runway 3, for example, had become difficult, almost agonizing. In the last couple of weeks, he had found himself coming back to the apartment from Dave's video stop, empty-handed more and more often. Not because there was nothing at Dave's he wanted to watch, but because there was too much. He couldn't decide if he wanted one of the Dirty Harry movies, or a Billy Crystal comedy, or maybe a few old Star Trek episodes. After a couple of these unsuccessful trips, he had plopped himself down in this very wing chair, almost crying with frustration, and he supposed fear. That creeping sensory numbness and the erosion of his decision-making capabilities were not the only problems he had come to associate with the insomnia. His short-term memory had also begun to slip. It had been his practice to go to the movies at least once and sometimes twice a week ever since his retirement from the print shop where he'd finished his working life as the bookkeeper and general supervisor. He'd taken Carolyn until last year, when she had gotten too sick to enjoy going out anywhere. After her death, he had mostly gone alone, although Helen Deepnow had accompanied him once or twice when Ed was home to mind the baby. Ed himself almost never went, claiming he got headaches at the movies. Ralph had gotten so used to calling the cinema center's answering machine to check showtimes that he'd had the number by heart. As the summer went on, however, he found himself having to look it up in the yellow pages more and more often. He could no longer be sure if the last 4 digits were 1317 or 1713. "It's 1713," he said now. "I know it is." But did he know it? Did he really? "Call Litchfield back. Go on, Ralph. Stop sifting through the wreckage. Do something constructive. And if Litchfield really sticks in your craw, call somebody else. The phone book's as full of doctors as it ever was." Probably true, but 70 was maybe a little old to be picking a new sawbones by the eeny, meeny, miny, moe method. And he wasn't going to call Litchfield back, period. "Okay, so what's next, you stubborn old goat? A few more folk remedies? I hope not, because at the rate you're going, you'll be down to Eye of Newt and Tongue of Toad in no time." The answer that came was like a cool breeze on a hot day, and it was an absurdly simple answer. All his book research this summer had been aimed at understanding the problem rather than finding a solution. When it came to answers, he had relied almost solely on backfence remedies like whiskey and honey, even when the books had already assured him they probably wouldn't work or would only work for a while. Although the books did offer some presumably reliable methods for coping with insomnia, the only one Ralph had actually tried was the simplest and most obvious, going to bed earlier in the evening. That solution hadn't worked. He had simply lain awake until 11:30 or so, then dropped off to wake at his new, earlier time. But something else might. It was worth a try anyway. Instead of spending the afternoon in his usual frenzy of backyard pottering, Ralph went down to the library and skimmed through some of the books he had already looked at. The general consensus seemed to be that if going to bed earlier didn't work, going later might. Ralph went home, mindful of his earlier adventures, he took the bus, filled with cautious hope. It might work. If it didn't, he always had Bach, Beethoven, and William Ackerman to fall back on. His first attempt at this technique, which one of the texts called delayed sleep, was comic. He awoke at his now usual time, 3:45 by the digital clock on the living room mantel, with a sore back, an aching neck, no immediate idea of how he'd gotten into the wing chair by the window, or why the TV was on, broadcasting nothing but snow and a soft, surf-like roar of static. It was only as he allowed his head to roll cautiously back, supporting the nape of his neck with a cupped palm, that he realized what had happened. He had intended to sit up until at least 3 o'clock and possibly 4. He would then stroll off to bed and sleep the sleep of the just. That had been the plan, anyway. Instead, the incredible insomniac of Harris Avenue had dropped off during Jay Leno's opening monologue, like a kid who's trying to stay up all night long just to see what it's like. And then, of course, he had finished the adventure by waking up at his now usual time. The problem was the same, Joe Friday might have said. Only the location had changed. Ralph strolled off to bed anyway, hoping against hope. But the urge, if not the need to sleep, had passed. After an hour of lying awake, he had gone back to the wing chair again, this time with a pillow propped behind his stiff neck and a rueful grin on his face. There was nothing funny about his second try, which took place the following night. Sleepiness began to steal over him at its usual time, 11:20, just as Pete Cherney was giving the following day's weather forecast. This time Ralph fought it successfully, making it all the way through Whoopi, although he almost nodded off during Whoopi's conversation with Roseanne Arnold, that evening's guest, and the late-night movie that came on after that. It was an old Audie Murphy flick, in which Audie appeared to be winning the war in the Pacific pretty much single-handed. It sometimes seemed to Ralph that there was an unspoken rule among local TV broadcasters which stated that movies telecast in the small hours of the morning could only star Audie Murphy or James Brolin. After the last Japanese pillbox had been blown up, Channel 2 signed off. Ralph dialed around, looking for another movie, and found nothing but snow. He supposed he could have watched movies all night if he had the cable, like Bill downstairs or Lois down the street. He remembered having put that on his list of things to do in the new year. But then Carolyn had died, and cable TV, with or without home box office, had no longer seemed very important. He found a copy of Sports Illustrated and began to slog through an article on women's tennis he'd missed the first time through, glancing up at the clock every now and then as the hands began to close in on 3 a.m. He'd become all but convinced that this was going to work. His eyelids were so heavy they felt as if they had been dipped in concrete. And although he was reading the tennis article carefully, word for word, he had no idea of what the writer was driving at. Whole sentences zipped across his brain without sticking, like cosmic rays. "I'm going to sleep tonight. I really think I am. For the first time in months, the sun is going to have to come up without my help. And that isn't just good, friends and neighbors. That is great." Then, shortly after 3 o'clock, that pleasant drowsiness began to disappear. It did not go with a champagne cork pop, but rather seemed to ooze away, like sand through a fine sieve or water down a partially clogged drain. When Ralph realized what was happening, it wasn't panic he felt, but sick dismay. It was a feeling he had come to recognize as the true opposite of hope. And when he slipper-scuffed his way into the bedroom at 3:15, he couldn't remember a depression as deep as the one which now enveloped him. He felt as if he was suffocating in it. "Please, God, just 40 winks," he muttered as he turned off the light. But he strongly suspected that this was one prayer which was not going to be answered. It wasn't. Although he'd been awake for 24 hours by then, every trace of sleepiness had left his mind and body by 4:15. He was tired. Yes, more deeply and fundamentally tired than he'd ever been in his life. But being tired and being sleepy, he had discovered, was sometimes poles apart. Sleep, that undiscriminating friend, humankind's best and most reliable nurse since the dawn of time, had abandoned him again. By 4:00, Ralph's bed had become hateful to him, as it always did when he realized he could put it to no good use. He swung his feet back onto the floor, scratching the mat of hair, almost entirely gray now, which curled through his mostly unbuttoned pajama top. He slid on his slippers again and scuffed back to the living room, where he dropped into the wingback chair and looked down at Harris Avenue. It was laid out like a stage set, where the only actor currently on view wasn't even human. It was a stray dog moving slowly down Harris Avenue in the direction of Strawford Park and up Mile Hill. It held its left rear leg up as much as possible, limping along as best it could on the other three. "Hi there, Rosalie," Ralph muttered, and rubbed a hand across his eyes. It was a Thursday morning, garbage pickup day on Harris Avenue, so he wasn't surprised to see Rosalie, who'd been a wandering here and there fixture in the neighborhood for the last year or so. She made her way down the street in leisurely fashion, investigating the rows and clusters of cans with the discrimination of a jaded flea market shopper. Now Rosalie, who was limping worse than ever this morning, and looked as tired as Ralph felt, found what looked like a good-sized beef bone and trotted away with it in her mouth. Ralph watched her out of sight, then simply sat with his hands folded in his lap, gazing out on the silent neighborhood where the orange high-intensity lamps added to the illusion that Harris Avenue was nothing but a stage set, standing deserted after the evening performance had ended and the actors had gone home. They shone down like spotlights in a perfect diminishing perspective that was surreal and hallucinatory. Ralph Roberts sat in the wing chair where he had spent so many early morning hours lately and waited for light and movement to invest the lifeless world below him. Finally, the first human actor, Pat the Paperboy, entered stage right, riding his Rory. He biked his way up the street, tossing rolled newspapers from the bag slung over his shoulder and hitting the porches he aimed at with a fair degree of accuracy. Ralph watched him a while, then heaved a sigh which felt as if it had come all the way from the basement, and got up to make tea. "I don't remember ever reading about this shit in my horoscope," he said hollowly, and then turned on the kitchen tap and began to fill the kettle. That long Thursday morning and even longer Thursday afternoon taught Roberts a valuable lesson. Not to sneer at 3 or 4 hours sleep a night simply because he had spent his entire life under the mistaken impression that he had a right to at least 6 and usually 7. It also served as a hideous preview. If things didn't improve, he could look forward to feeling like this most of the time. Hell, all of the time. He went into the bedroom at 10:00 and again at 1, hoping for a little nap. Even a cat nap would do, and half an hour would be a lifesaver. But he could not so much as drowse. He was miserably tired, but not in the least bit sleepy. Around 3:00, he decided to make himself a Lipton cup of soup. He filled the tea kettle with fresh water, put it on to boil, and opened the cupboard over the counter where he kept condiments, spices, and various envelopes containing foods which only astronauts and old men actually seem to eat. Powders to which the consumer needs only add hot water. He pushed cans and bottles around in aimless fashion and then simply stared into the cupboard for a while, as if expecting the box of soup packets to magically appear in the space he had made. When they didn't, he would repeat the process, only this time moving things back to their original positions before staring in again with a look of distant perplexity which was becoming, Ralph mercifully did not know this, his dominant expression. When the tea kettle shrieked, he put it on one of the rear burners and went back to staring into the cupboard. It dawned on him, very, very slowly, that he must have drunk his last packet of cup of soup yesterday or the day before, although he could not for the life of him remember doing so. "That's a surprise," he asked the boxes and bottles in the open cupboard. "I'm so tired I can't remember my own name." "Yes, I can," he thought. "It's Leon Redbone. So there." It wasn't much of a joke, but he felt a small smile. It felt as light as a feather touch his lips. He stepped into the bathroom, combed his hair, and then went downstairs. "Here's Audie Murphy heading out into enemy territory in search of supplies," he thought. "Primary target, one box of Lipton chicken rice cup of soup packets. If locating and securing this target should prove impossible, I'll divert to my secondary, noodles and beef. I know this is a risky mission, but..." "But I work best alone," he finished as he came out on the porch. Old Mrs. Perrine happened to be passing, and she favored Ralph with a sharp look, but said nothing. He waited for her to get a little way up the sidewalk. He did not feel capable of conversation with anyone this afternoon, least of all Mrs. Perrine, who at 82 could still have found stimulating and useful work among the Marines at Paris Island. He pretended to be examining the spider plant, which hung from the hook under the porch eave, until she had reached what he deemed a safe distance, then crossed Harris Avenue to the Red Apple, which was where the day's real troubles began. He entered the convenience store once again, mulling over the spectacular failure of the delayed sleep experiment, and wondering if the advice in the library texts was no more than an uptown version of the folk remedies his acquaintances seemed so eager to press upon him. It was an unpleasant idea, but he thought his mind, or the force below his mind, which was actually in charge of this slow torture, had sent him a message which was even more unpleasant. "You have a sleep window, Ralph. It's not as big as it once was, and it seems to be getting smaller with every passing week. But you better be grateful for what you've got, because a small window is better than no window at all. You can see that now, don't you?" "Yes," Ralph mumbled as he walked down the center aisle to the bright red cup of soup boxes. "I see that very well." Sue, the afternoon counter girl, laughed cheerfully. "You must have money in the bank, Ralph," she said. "Beg pardon?" Ralph didn't turn. He was inventorying the red boxes. Here was onion, split pea, the beef and noodles combo. But where the hell was the chicken and rice? "My mom always said people who talk to themselves have..." Oh, my God! For a moment, Ralph thought she had simply made a statement a little too complex for his tired mind to immediately grasp. Something about how people who talk to themselves had found God. And then she screamed. He had hunkered down to check the boxes on the bottom shelf, and the scream shot him to his feet so hard and fast that his knees popped. He wheeled toward the front of the store, bumping the top shelf of the soup display with his elbow and knocking half a dozen red boxes into the aisle. "Sue? What's wrong?" Sue paid no attention. She was looking out through the door with her fisted hands pressed against her lips and her brown eyes huge above them. "God, look at the blood!" she cried in a choked voice. Ralph turned further, knocking a few more Lipton boxes into the aisle, and looked through the Red Apple's dirty show window. What he saw drew a gasp from him, and it took him a space of seconds, five maybe, to realize that the bloody beaten woman staggering toward the Red Apple was Helen Deepnow. Ralph had always thought Helen the prettiest woman on the west side of town, but there was nothing pretty about her today. One of her eyes was puffed shut. There was a gash at her left temple that was soon going to be lost in the gaudy swelling of a fresh bruise. Her puffy lips and her cheeks were covered with blood. The blood had come from her nose, which was still leaking. She wove through the Red Apple's little parking lot toward the door like a drunk, her one good eye seeming to see nothing. It simply stared. More frightening than the way she looked was the way she was handling Natalie. She had the squalling, frightened baby slung casually on one hip, carrying her as she might have carried her books to high school 10 or 12 years before. "Oh, Jesus, she's going to drop the kid," Sue screamed. But although she was 10 steps closer to the door than he was, she made no move, simply stood where she was with her hands pressed to her mouth and her eyes gobbling up her face. Ralph suddenly didn't feel tired anymore. He sprinted up the aisle, tore open the door, and ran outside. He was just in time to catch Helen by the shoulders as she banged a hip against the ice cabinet, mercifully not the hip with Natalie on it, and went veering off in a new direction. "Helen," he yelled. Jesus, Helen, what happened? Huh? She asked, her voice dully curious, totally unlike the voice of the lively young woman who sometimes accompanied him to the movies and moaned over Mel Gibson. Her good eye rolled toward him, and he saw that same dull curiosity in it, a look that said she didn't know who she was, let alone where she was, or what had happened, or when. Huh? Ralph? Huh? The baby slipped. Ralph let go of Helen, grabbed for Natalie, and managed to snag one of her jumper straps. Nat screamed, waved her hands, and stared at him with huge dark blue eyes. He got his other hand between Nat's legs an instant before the strap he was holding tore free. For a moment, the howling baby balanced on his hand like a gymnast on a balance beam, and Ralph could feel the damp bulge of her diapers through the overall she was wearing. Then he slipped his other hand around her back and hoisted her up against his chest. His heart was pounding hard, and even with the baby safe in his arms, he kept seeing her slip away, kept seeing her head with its cap of fine downy hair slamming against the butt-lidded pavement with a sickening crack. Huh? Ralph? Helen asked. She saw Natalie in Ralph's arms, and some of the dullness went out of her good eye. She raised her hands toward the child, and in Ralph's arms, Natalie mimicked the gesture with her own chubby hands. Then Helen staggered, struck the side of the building, and reeled backward a step, one foot tangled in the other. Ralph saw splatters of blood on her small white sneakers, and it was amazing how bright everything was all of a sudden. The color had come back into the world, at least temporarily. And she would have fallen if Sue hadn't picked that moment to finally venture out. Instead of going down, Helen landed against the opening door and just leaned there like a drunk against a lamppost. Ralph? The expression in her eyes was a little sharper now, and Ralph saw it wasn't so much curiosity as incredulity. She drew in a deep breath and made an effort to force intelligible words past her swelled lips.
Give me my baby. Baby, give me Nolly.
Not just yet, Helen, Ralph said. You're not too steady on your feet right now. Sue was still on the other side of the door, holding it so Helen wouldn't fall. The girl's cheeks and forehead were ashy pale, her eyes filled with tears. Get out here, Ralph told her. Hold her up.
I can't, she blubbered. She's all bloody.
Oh, for God's sake, quit it. It's Helen, Helen Deepnow from up the street. And although Sue must have known that, actually hearing the name seemed to turn the trick. She slipped around the open door, and when Helen staggered backward again, Sue curled an arm around her shoulders and braced her firmly. That expression of incredulous surprise remained on Helen's face. Ralph found it harder and harder to look at. It made him feel sick to his stomach. Ralph, what happened? Was it an accident? He turned his head and saw Bill McGovern standing at the edge of the parking lot. He was wearing one of his natty blue shirts with the iron's creases still in the sleeves and holding one of his long-fingered, oddly delicate hands up to shade his eyes. He looked strange, somehow naked that way. But Ralph had no time to think about why. Too much was happening. It was no accident, he said. She's been beaten up. Here, take the kid. He held Natalie out to McGovern, who at first shrank back and then took the baby. Natalie immediately began to shriek again. McGovern, looking like someone who has just been handed an overfilled airsick bag, held her out at arm's length with her feet dangling. Behind him, a small crowd was beginning to gather, many of them teenage kids in baseball uniforms on their way home from an afternoon game at the field around the corner. They were staring at Helen's puffed and bloody face with an unpleasant avidity, and Ralph found himself thinking of the Bible story about the time Noah had gotten drunk on the ark. The good sons who had looked away from the naked old man lying on his pallet, the bad one who had looked and laughed. Gently he replaced Sue's arm with his own. Helen's good eye rolled back to him. She said his name more clearly this time, more positively, and the gratitude Ralph heard in her blurry voice made him feel like crying. Sue, take the baby. Bill doesn't have a clue. She did, folding Nat gently and expertly into her arms. McGovern gave her a grateful smile, and Ralph suddenly realized what was wrong with the way he looked. McGovern wasn't wearing the Panama hat, which seemed as much a part of him, in the summertime at least, as the wind on the bridge of his nose. "Hey, mister, what happened?" one of the baseball kids asked. Nothing that's any of your business, Ralph said.
Looks like she went a few rounds with Riddick Bowe.
Nah, Tyson, one of the other baseball kids said, and incredibly there was laughter.
Get out of here, Ralph shouted at them, suddenly furious. Go peddle your papers, mind your business.
They shuffled back a few steps, but no one left. It was blood they were looking at, and not on a movie screen. Helen, can you walk?
Yes, she said. Think so.
He led her carefully around the open door and into the Red Apple. She moved slowly, shuffling from foot to foot like an old woman. The smell of sweat and spent adrenaline was baking out of her pores in a sour reek. And Ralph felt his stomach turn over again. It wasn't the smell, not really. It was the effort to reconcile this Helen with the pert and pleasantly sexy woman he had spoken to yesterday while she worked in her flower beds. Ralph suddenly remembered something else about yesterday. Helen had been wearing blue shorts, cut quite high, and he had noticed a couple of bruises on her legs. A large yellow blotch far up on the left thigh, a fresher, darker smudge on the right calf. He walked Helen toward the little office area behind the cash register. He glanced up into the convex anti-theft mirror mounted in the corner and saw McGovern holding the door for Sue.
Lock the door, he said over his shoulder.
Gee, Ralph, I'm not supposed to.
Just for a couple of minutes, Ralph said. Please.
Well, okay, I guess.
Ralph heard the snick of the bolt being turned as he eased Helen into the hard plastic contour chair behind the littery desk. He picked up the telephone and punched the button marked 911. Before the phone could ring on the other end, a blood-streaked hand reached out and pushed down the gray disconnect button.
Go, Ralph!
She swallowed with an obvious effort and tried again.
Don't!
Yes, Ralph said, I'm going to. Now it was fear he saw in her one good eye, and nothing dull about it.
No, she said. Please, Ralph, don't!
She looked past him and held out her hands again. The humble, pleading look on her beaten face made Ralph wince with dismay.
Ralph, Sue asked, she wants the baby.
I know. Go ahead. Sue handed Natalie to Helen, and Ralph watched as the baby, a little over a year old now, he was pretty sure, put her arms around her mother's neck and her face against her mother's shoulder. Helen kissed the top of Nat's head. It clearly hurt her to do this, but she did it again. And then again. Looking down at her, Ralph could see blood grimed into the faint creases on the nape of Helen's neck, like dirt. As he looked at this, he felt the anger begin to pulse again.
It was Ed, wasn't it? He asked.
Of course it was. You didn't hit the cut-off button on the phone when someone tried to call 911 if you'd been beaten up by a total stranger. But he had to ask.
Yes, she said.
Her voice was no more than a whisper. The answer a secret imparted into the fine cloud of her baby daughter's hair.
Yes, it was Ed. But you can't call the police.
She looked up now, the good eye full of fear and misery.
Please, don't call the police, Ralph. I can't bear to think of Natalie's dad in jail for...
Helen burst into tears. Natalie goggled at her mother for a moment in comic surprise, and then joined her.
Ralph, McGovern asked hesitantly, do you want me to get her some Tylenol or something?
Better not, he said. We don't know what's wrong with her, how bad she might be hurt. His eyes shifted to the show window, not wanting to see what was out there, hoping not to, and seeing it anyway. Avid faces lined up all the way down to the place where the beer cooler cut off the view. Some of them were cupping their hands to the sides of their faces to cut the glare.
What should we do, you guys? Sue asked.
She was looking at the gawkers and picking nervously at the hem of the Red Apple duster employees had to wear.
If the company finds out I locked the door during business hours, I'm apt to lose my job.
Helen tugged at his hand.
Please, Ralph, she repeated. Only it came out, please, Ralph,
through her swollen lips.
Don't call anybody.
Ralph looked at her uncertainly. He had seen a lot of women wearing a lot of bruises over the course of his life, and a couple, although not many in all honesty, who had been beaten much more severely than Helen. It hadn't always seemed this grim, though. His mind and morals had been formed at a time when people believed that what went on between a husband and wife behind the closed doors of their marriage was their business, and that included the man who hit with his fists and the woman who cut with her tongue. You couldn't make people behave, and meddling into their affairs, even with the best of intentions, all too often turned friends into enemies. But then he thought of the way she had been carrying Natalie as she staggered across the parking lot, held casually on one hip like a textbook. If she had dropped the baby in the parking lot, or crossing Harris Avenue, she probably wouldn't have known it. Ralph guessed that it was nothing but instinct that had caused Helen to take the baby in the first place. She hadn't wanted to leave Nat in the care of the man who had beaten her so badly she could only see out of one eye and talk in mushy, rounded syllables. He thought of something else as well, something that had to do with the days following Carolyn's death earlier in the year. He'd been surprised at the depth of his grief. It had been an expected death, after all. He had believed he had taken care of most of his grieving while Carolyn was still alive, and it had rendered him awkward and ineffective about the final arrangements which needed to be made. He had managed the call to the Brookings Smith funeral home, but it was Helen who had gotten the obit form from the Derry News and helped him to fill it out. Helen, who had gone with him to pick out a coffin. McGovern, who hated death and the trappings which surrounded it, had made himself scarce. And Helen, who had helped him choose a floral centerpiece, the one which said, "Beloved Wife." And it had been Helen, of course, who had orchestrated the little party afterward, providing sandwiches from Frank's Catering and soft drinks and beer from the Red Apple. These were things Helen had done for him when he could not do them for himself. Did he not have an obligation to repay her kindness, even if Helen might not see it as kindness right now? "Bill," he asked, "what do you think?" McGovern looked from Ralph to Helen, sitting in the red plastic chair with her battered face lowered, and then back to Ralph again. He produced a handkerchief and wiped his lips nervously. "I don't know. I like Helen a lot, and I want to do the right thing. You know I do, but something like this, who knows what the right thing is?" Ralph suddenly remembered what Carolyn used to say whenever he started moaning and bitching about some chore he didn't want to do, some errand he didn't want to run, or some duty call he didn't want to make. "It's a long walk back to Eden, sweetheart, so don't sweat the small stuff." He reached for the phone again, and this time when Helen reached for his wrist, he pushed it away. "You've reached the Derry Police Department," a recorded voice told him. "Push 1 for emergency services. Push 2 for police services. Push 3 for information." Ralph, who suddenly understood he needed all 3, hesitated for a second, and then pushed 2. The telephone buzzed and a woman's voice said, "This is police 911. How may I help you?" He took a deep breath and said, "This is Ralph Roberts. I'm at the Red Apple store on Harris Avenue with my neighbor from up the street. Her name is Helen Deepnow. She's been beaten up pretty badly." He put his hand gently on the side of Helen's face and she pressed her forehead against his side. He could feel the heat of her skin through his shirt. "Please, come as fast as you can." He hung the telephone up, then squatted down next to Helen. Natalie saw him, crowed with delight, and reached out to give his nose a friendly honk. Ralph smiled, kissed her tiny palm, then looked into Helen's face. "I'm sorry, Helen," he said, "but I had to. I couldn't not do it. Do you understand that? I couldn't not do it."
I don't understand anything," she said. Her nose had stopped bleeding, but when she reached up to swipe at it, she winced back from a touch of her own fingers.
"Helen, why did he do it? Why would Ed beat you up like this?" He found himself remembering other bruises, mostly on Helen's arms. A pattern of them, perhaps. If there had been a pattern, he had missed it until now. Because of Carolyn's death, and because of the insomnia which had come afterward. In any case, he did not believe this was the first time Ed had put his hands on his wife. Today might have been a drastic escalation, but it hadn't been the first time. He could grasp that idea and admit its logic, but he discovered he still couldn't see Ed doing it. He could see Ed's quick grin, his lively eyes, the way his hands moved restlessly when he talked, but he couldn't see Ed using those hands to beat the crap out of his wife, no matter how hard he tried. Then a memory resurfaced. A memory of Ed walking stiff-legged toward the man who had been driving the blue pickup. It had been a Ford Ranger, hadn't it?
and then flicking the flat of his hand across the heavy-set man's jowls. Remembering that was like opening the door of Fibber McGee's closet in that old radio show. Only what came falling out wasn't an avalanche of old store junk, but a series of vivid images from that day last July. The Thunderheads building over the airport, Ed's arm popping out of the Datsun's window and waving up and down as if he could make the gate slide open faster that way. The scarf with the Chinese symbol on it. "Hey, hey, Susan Day, how many kids did you kill today?" Ralph thought, only it was Ed's voice he heard, and he pretty well knew what Helen was going to say before she even opened her mouth. "So stupid," she said dully. "He hit me because I signed a petition. That's all it was. They're circulating all over town. Someone pushed it into my face when I was going into the supermarket day before yesterday. He said something about a benefit for woman care, and that seemed all right. Besides, the baby was fussing, so I just..." "You just signed it," Ralph finished softly. She nodded and began to cry again. "What petition?" McGovern asked. "To bring Susan Day to Derry," Ralph told him. "She's a feminist..." "I know who Susan Day is," McGovern said irritably. "Anyway, a bunch of people are trying to get her here to speak on behalf of woman care." "When Ed came home today, he was in a great mood," Helen said through her tears. "He almost always is on Thursdays, because it's his half day. He was talking about how he was going to spend the afternoon pretending to read a book, and actually just watching the sprinkler go around. You know how he is." "Yes," Ralph said, remembering how Ed had plunged his arm into one of the heavy-set man's barrels. And the crafty grin, "I know a trick worth two of that," on his face. "Yes, I know how he is. I sent him out to get some baby formula," her voice was rising, becoming fretful and frightened. "I didn't know he'd be upset. I'd all but forgotten about signing the damn thing, to tell the truth. And I still don't know exactly why he was so upset, but when he came back..." She hugged Natalie to her, trembling. "Shh, Helen, take it easy. Everything's okay." "No, it's not." She looked up at him, tears streaming from one eye and seeping out from beneath the swelled lid of the other. "It's not... no, not..." "Why didn't he stop this time? And what's going to happen to me and the baby? Where will we go? I don't have any money except for what's in the joint checking account. I don't have a job. Oh, Ralph, why did you call the police? You shouldn't have done that." And she hit his forearm with a strengthless little fist. "You're going to get through this just fine," he said. "You've got a lot of friends in the neighborhood." But he barely heard what he was saying and hadn't felt her small punch at all. The anger was thudding away in his chest and at his temples like a second heartbeat. Not why didn't he stop? That wasn't what she had said. What she had said was, why didn't he stop this time? This time. "Helen, where's Ed now?" "Home, I guess," she said dully. Ralph patted her on the shoulder, then turned and started for the door. "Ralph?" Bill McGovern asked. He sounded alarmed. "Where are you going?" "Lock the door after me," Ralph told Sue. "Geez, I don't know if I can do that." Sue looked doubtfully at the line of gawkers peering in through the dirty window. There were more of them now. "You can," he said, then cocked his head, catching the first faint wail of an approaching siren. "Hear that?" "Yes, but the cops will tell you what to do, and your boss won't be mad at you either. He'll probably give you a medal for handling everything just right." "If he does, I'll split it with you," she said, then glanced at Helen again. A little color had come back into Sue's cheeks, but not much. Jeepers, Ralph, look at her. Did he really beat her up because she signed some stupid paper in Shaw's? "I guess so," Ralph said. The conversation made perfect sense to him, but it was coming in long distance. His rage was closer. It had its hot arms locked around his neck, it seemed. He wished he were 40 again, even 50, so he could give Ed a taste of his own medicine. And he had an idea he might try doing that anyway. He was turning the thumb bolt of the door when McGovern grabbed his shoulder. "What do you think you're doing?" "Going to see Ed." "Are you kidding? He'll take you apart if you get in his face. Didn't you see what he did to her?" "You bet I did," Ralph replied. The words weren't quite a snarl, but close enough to make McGovern drop his hand. "You're 70 fucking years old, Ralph, in case you forgot. and Helen needs a friend right now, not some busted-up antique she can visit because his hospital room is three doors down from hers. Bill was right, of course, but that only made Ralph angrier. He supposed the insomnia was at work in this, too, stoking his anger and blurring his judgment. But that made no difference. In a way, the anger was a relief. It was better, certainly, than drifting through a world where everything had turned shades of dark gray. "If he beats me up bad enough, they'll give me some Demerol and I can get a decent night's sleep," he said. "Now leave me alone, Bill." He crossed the Red Apple parking lot at a brisk walk. A police car was approaching, with its blue grill flashes pulsing. Questions. "What happened? She okay?" were thrown at him, but Ralph ignored them. He paused on the sidewalk, waited for the police car to swing into the parking lot, then crossed Harris Avenue at that same brisk walk with McGovern trailing anxiously after him at a prudent distance.